ex-long-standing strictures regarding divorce and remarriage. Traditionally, strict evangelical teaching has frowned strongly on divorce and sanctioned remarriage only for those whose spouses were guilty of adultery. In practice, many people who divorce for reasons other than adultery remarry and continue to attend church, but they are often the cause of some awkwardness for all parties. And many divorced evangelicals either remain single out of explicit fear of eternal punishment, or if they choose to remarry, move to new churches to give themselves a fresh start. As the high divorce rates prevalent in the larger society began to appear in evangelical circles, the churches have not only shown a greater tolerance for what they once regarded as a notable aberration, but have made the singles ministry, which typically includes a substantial divorce contingent, a major feature of many successful congregations. Graham felt more comfortable with the traditional teaching. In describing a case in which a divorced woman had remarried, he discreetly noted, without giving details, that she was free to remarry, meaning that her husband had committed adultery. And what of those who are the sinners instead of the sinned against? If they are not the innocent party, he replied, there is a question in my mind. Not a definite yes or no. I'm not a legalist. Some of these things have to be taken case by case, point by point. God can forgive adultery. His frequent use of the phrase, you can't unscramble eggs, when referring to such cases, indicated a pragmatic belief that trusting God to forgive all sorts of past mistakes is a more viable course of action than trying to rewrite history. Graham also moderated other views regarding the family. In earlier years, he spoke of the husband as the master of the house, who organizes it, holds it together, and controls it, and had counseled wives to remain in subjection to their husbands. By the mid-1970s, he had absorbed enough feminist rhetoric to cause him to rethink his position. Volunteering that he had based his earlier views on a misinterpretation of the Bible, he said, "I believe the biblical position on women's rights is that the husband and wife are equal." He still believed that in the governing organization of the home, the husband is the head, but was willing to concede that the woman is also the head in certain areas, and there is an equal responsibility in the home. Like vice presidents in a corporation, they have equal status but manage different divisions. In this kind of arrangement, subjection would not be an issue. Husbands and wives would submit to each other. Predictably, he decried a feminist tendency to devalue the role of wife and mother as a satanic deception of modern times, but conceded that there are things in today's feminist movement that I like, because I think women have been discriminated against. Such views, of course, were hardly radical, even in evangelical circles, but Graham took a somewhat bolder step by lending support, or at least not offering opposition, to the ordination of women. In 1975, he admitted that he was simply not sure about what position to take on this touchy subject. 2 years later, he said, "I don't object to it like some do, because so many of the leaders of the early church were women. They prophesied, they taught. You go on the mission fields today, and many of our missionaries are women who are preachers and teachers. As for women as pastors, I think it's coming, probably. I think it will be accepted more and more. I know a lot of women who are far superior to men when it comes to ministering to others. Men might resist giving them full rights in the church, but such women are ordained of God, whether they had men to lay hands on them and give them a piece of paper or not. I think God called them." A decade later, following the pattern he had set in dealing with blacks during the 1950s, Graham had quietly placed his stamp of approval on women ministers by including them, albeit in small numbers, in BGEA-sponsored conferences, and by inviting them to lead prayer and take other public roles in his crusades. Just as association with world church leaders had given Graham a more flexible attitude toward theological positions different from the fundamentalist revivalism in which he had been raised, so his exposure to the full range of the world's political and economic systems had made him less confident that Western-style free enterprise capitalism would be the system of choice in the millennium. While still voicing a clear preference for the free enterprise system, he said, "I don't think it's the only one that Christians can support. we are a socialist society compared to, let's say, the days of Franklin Roosevelt. There has to be a certain amount of socialism. The inequity between rich and poor, including disparities between wealthy and developing nations, he observed, is going to have to change somehow, whether voluntarily or by law. You can't have some people driving Cadillacs and other people driving ox carts and expect peace in the community. There is a crying need for more social justice. It's a problem whose solution is beyond me. But I found about 250 verses in the Bible on our responsibility to the poor. Even though he had supported Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, Graham had retained a slight cynicism toward such government programs. In 1969, he spoke with approval at having seen a poster that read, "I fight poverty, I work." And he criticized the motives of those who backed anti-poverty legislation by observing that many people carry a heavy load for poverty because they want votes, and others want to get involved in the problems so they can get their hand in the till. He conceded that the existence of opportunists and grifters should never do away with our responsibility for the legitimate poor, but his portrait surely gave comfort to those inclined to blame the poor for their own plight. He also continued to maintain a somewhat fatalistic attitude toward poverty, citing Jesus' observation, "The poor you have with you always," and reiterating his belief that only the second coming and the millennium would bring true relief from the world's enduring problems. Repeated first-hand exposure to human suffering eventually had its effect on Graham's native compassion, and he gradually began both to enlist his organization in the struggle against poverty and to acknowledge that poverty had other than individual roots and that something more sweeping than philanthropy would be required to ease the world's suffering. From the very beginning, he said, "I felt that if I came upon a person who had been beaten and robbed and left for dead, that I'd do my best to help him. I also felt that this applied to my relatives and friends and immediate neighbors. But I never thought of it in terms of corporate responsibility. I had no real idea that millions of people throughout the world lived on the knife edge of starvation, and that the teachings of the Bible demanded that I have a response toward them. As I've traveled around through India and Africa and Latin America and all those places for all these years, it can't help but be a heavy pressure. For a person who hasn't been there and touched those people and seen those people, it is really difficult to explain, but as I traveled and studied the Bible more, I changed." In 1973, BGEA inaugurated its World Emergency Fund to provide a more routinized way of responding to similar needs. Aware of the criticism some relief agencies receive for the proportion of their incomes they spend in overhead, Graham took deserved pleasure in noting that not one penny of the monies contributed specifically to this fund was siphoned off for administrative purposes. More as an example than as a serious attempt to alleviate hunger, Graham's later crusades included a program called Love in Action, in which people were asked to contribute non-perishable food to the service for distribution through reputable social agencies. Typically, this effort brought in several tons of canned and boxed goods, but Graham freely admitted its limitations and symbolic purpose. "Of course, we can't feed all the hungry people. It's only a gesture to demonstrate what we ought to do all the time. If the churches and synagogues did what they could do, we would not have to have such a confused welfare system." By the early 1980s, Graham was beginning to echo Roman Catholic statements about God's presumed preferential option for the poor. During an address at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, he astonished the school's dean, a former resident of Charlotte, and many of the students gathered to hear him when he said, "As a Christian, I believe that God has a special concern for the poor of the world, and public policy should in some way reflect this concern. I believe God has a special concern for things like peace, racism, the responsible use of Earth's resources, economic and social justice, the use of power, and the sacredness of human life." He admitted that how these matters are to be implemented is a very complex matter, and confessed that, "I have not always seen many of the complexities. I'm still learning. But I've come to see in deeper ways some of the implications of my faith and the message that I've been proclaiming." In Approaching Hoofbeats, which appeared the following year, he offered details on the worldwide scope of such problems as hunger and infant mortality, asserted that the disparity between the rich and the poor is one of the basic causes of social unrest in Central America and other parts of the world, and condemned the indifference of certain governments to the plight of their own people. And by the end of the 1980s, he was insisting that the United States do its part for underprivileged nations by helping them gain relief from international debt. Though he recognized that Americans would bridle at the austerity such a policy would entail, since it would inevitably increase the tax burden on Americans, he saw no other alternative. "I think we've got to help them with this debt," he said. "It's threatening Latin countries and countries throughout the world, and we've got to do something about it." The evangelist was also willing to identify, or at least to sympathize publicly, with groups that had once drawn his barely disguised scorn. During a two-installment tour of British cities in 1984 and 1985, he repeatedly expressed concern for the unemployed, making it clear that he no longer regarded people who were out of work as willfully lazy. "The most important thing, apart from finding jobs," he said, "is that unemployed people should not be made to feel that they are second-class citizens. Christians should be deeply concerned for the problems of society and should be supportive of those who are socially deprived." While preaching in the industrial city of Sheffield, he met with miners who had been involved in a brutal union dispute to suggest how Christian teaching might apply to their situation. Details of their conversations were not revealed, but they apparently went beyond the pious palliatives that have led many British working people to give up on the church. The president of the National Union of Mine Workers called the meeting extremely useful, and Graham, while insisting he did not know enough about the situation to take sides, did the miners' cause no harm by saying, "My heart goes out to people who hurt." British churchmen, who have often faulted Graham for excessive individualism, profess to be gratified by the way in which the social awareness of his maturity finally tempers the fundamentalist fires of his youth. Graham's views on crime and punishment also took on a more liberal cast. He grew more aware that not all crime is street crime or committed by poor people. Many of our crimes are committed in upper middle class or affluent environments, and believed that some form of gun control would be appropriate. He also developed reservations about capital punishment. "One of the hesitations I've had," he told a reporter, "is that so many blacks are executed. The system has always been too one-sided, and many of the people on death row are poor people who couldn't afford good lawyers. There is no perfect system of justice on this earth. God will have it at judgment. But this is a very imperfect system, and execution makes the imperfection final." At hearing her husband backtrack on some of his earlier law and order sentiments, Ruth frowned and bluntly interjected, "I'm for capital punishment. I think it is a deterrent. I know in countries where they have it, I feel safer walking down the streets." Unwilling to start an argument, but also unwilling to abandon his position, Graham gently responded, "Darling, there are countries where they have executions in which I don't feel safe at all." No shift in Graham's social thought drew more attention than his increased concern for peace and nuclear disarmament. Given the flack his 1982 visit to Moscow drew, he might easily have backed off his more dovish sentiments or claimed he had been misunderstood or misquoted. Instead, he stood by his plowshares and included an extended statement of his views on disarmament in his 1983 book, Approaching Hoofbeats. He began with a confession and a statement of repentance. "To limit the growing threat of nuclear warfare seems perfectly in line with Christ's call to be peacemakers on the earth," he said, but admitted that in those first years of the nuclear age, "I did very little in this particular area. I preached the gospel throughout the world, which was my primary calling. And I warned people against war in my sermons from the very beginning. But perhaps I should have done more. I wish now that I had taken a much stronger stand against the nuclear arms race at its beginning, when there was a chance of stopping it." He repeated his by now standard statement, that he was neither a pacifist nor an advocate of unilateral disarmament, and acknowledge that given the sinful nature of humankind, police and military forces would always be necessary in this temporal realm. Still, he regarded a worldwide concern for peace as a heartening sign, and he called on all Christians to rise above narrow national interests and to give all of humanity a spiritual vision of the way to peace. He then repeated the recommendations he had made at the 1982 Moscow conference. Urge all governments to respect the rights of religious believers, get to know one another personally, and encourage world leaders to work toward eliminating all nuclear and biochemical weapons of mass destruction. Graham's fear that either the Soviet Union or the United States would set off a major conflagration ebbed in the 1980s, but it was offset by concern over nuclear proliferation and the problems inherent in a situation in which the smaller nations, many nations not quite as stable, had or would soon have nuclear capability. Showing his willingness to draft such possibilities into the service of his invitation, he told a South Carolina audience, 15 to 25 nations have a nuclear capacity. Terrorists are also working on it and may have it. That's the reason you ought to come to Christ. He also continued to insist that no Secretary of State or government official shuttling back and forth between countries can lessen these international tensions. It may patch things up for a while, but only the coming of Christ will solve the problems. Still, his shift from a fatalistic view of nuclear war as the likely means God would use to launch Armageddon to a vision of world peace as a realistic present hope for which Christians ought to strive, and his seconding Dwight Eisenhower's 1953 observation that every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired, signifies in a final sense a theft from those who are hungry and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed, was real and significant. Christianity Today correctly characterized his interest in nuclear issues as something other than the scare tactics of a preacher who wants responses to his sermons. It reflected instead the agony of an evangelist and international diplomat who had discussed these problems with 7 U.S. presidents and other heads of state and world leaders and has dealt with more people searching for God than perhaps any man in history. Did Graham honestly think his vision of Salt 10 could ever be realized? Not likely, he admitted. But does that mean I should cease praying, speaking, and working for that day when the people of the earth will unite to remove the ever-present threat of nuclear holocaust? Again, no. I do not plan to be a leader in a peace movement or organization. I am an evangelist. But I am a man who is still in process. Chapter 36. What manner of man? Billy Graham genuinely believed what he preached, and his organization provided him with the means to accomplish what lesser lights can only dream about. But the crucial factor in explaining Billy Graham's unprecedented accomplishments as an evangelist and world Christian leader is Billy Graham himself. In a good evangelical fashion, his associates and admirers insist that any attempt to account for him on the human level is destined to seem trite, even foolish. Alan Emery uses the image of a turtle on a fence post. Any sensible person encountering that unlikely sight would immediately realize that the turtle had not crawled up there by himself, but had been placed there by some larger and more powerful force. The Reverend Maurice Wood, Bishop of Norwich and member of Britain's House of Lords, offered a similar assessment. I believe that in each generation God raises up certain people he can trust with success. I would put Billy in line with the Wesleys and St. Augustine. Toss Francis in, if you like. He's in that league anyway. And what's extraordinary is that he doesn't seem to know it. He doesn't want a Graham church. He is more interested in sharing the load than in grabbing the limelight. He wants to be a servant of the church, to challenge and spark the churches to be what they must become, the evangelizing agents of God and His Word. But there's no doubt about it. He is the most spiritually productive servant of God in our time. Some think it a waste of effort to speculate as to when or where the next such figure might arise. I honestly believe with all my heart that Billy Graham is the most important single thing God has done since the Apostle Paul, Lane Adams volunteered. He is the only man who has ever had the ear of the world this long. Could it be that he is like John the Baptist, making straight the way of the Lord? Perhaps he is giving one last clarion call for the second coming of the Savior. When you consider the advent of satellite communications, which makes it possible to have such a broad outreach, you can't help but stop and wonder. It is true that no person in modern history has done more than Billy Graham to bring to the world's attention the message and testimony of evangelical Christianity. Through his crusades, his conferences, his radio and television programs, his newspaper columns and magazine articles and books, his friendship with kings and queens and presidents and prime ministers, and his enduring omnipresence as a public figure. He forced millions of people to pay attention to a kind of religion that ordinarily astute observers predicted would vanish from all but the remotest and most backward of locations by the end of the 20th century. He stood for and personified the evangelical conviction that what the Bible says is what the Bible means. But he did so without encouraging the blatantly anti-intellectual tendencies that have often characterized fundamentalist and, to a lesser degree, evangelical Christianity. Moreover, his warm ecumenical heart melted barriers that traditionally separated evangelicals from more liberal Christians and repeatedly opened itself to non-Christians as well. Prominent rabbi Mark Tannenbaum said of him, "The American Jewish Committee can tell in moving chapter and verse how Dr. Graham came, time and again, to the aid of the embattled people of Israel. When his voice and influence in high places made a crucial and at times a decisive difference. Dr. Billy Graham has been and continues to be one of the greatest friends of the Jewish people and of Israel in the entire Christian world in the 20th century. And in recent years, when Muslims could easily have provided him with a convenient target for demagogic attacks, he repeatedly called attention to the commonality between Islam and the Judeo-Christian tradition, recommending that Christians go out of our way to love them, and pointing out that his son Franklin has visited Lebanon nearly 30 times to help rebuild Muslim homes destroyed by bombs. Franklin felt he needed to do something to show Islamic people that Christians could love them, in spite of the wars and the troubles. Just as he helped evangelicals make their presence felt in the mainstream of American religion, Graham also encouraged them to take a more active political role. Though he disliked being labeled the high priest of the American civil religion during the Johnson and Nixon years, and admitted he sometimes acted imprudently on behalf of his friends in the White House, he continued to encourage evangelicals to be involved in the political process, and showed them that their involvement need not be as fanatical and narrow-gauged as some of the efforts of the Christian New Right. In the process, his own political outlook had broadened and deepened. Eisenhower once said publicly that "I was the greatest ambassador that America had," he recalled. Of course, at the moment he said it in the 1950s, "I was pleased. Now I would not be pleased because I feel that my ministry today is a world ministry. Now when I say something, I think, how is this going to sound in India? How is it going to sound to my friends in Hungary or Poland? I don't ever want to dodge the truth, and I don't ever want to back down on my convictions. But I'm beginning to see that there are more sides to some of these questions than I once thought. I am not as dogmatic." Graham's ability to speak to American culture so successfully for 60 years stemmed in some measure from the fact that he was in many ways an apotheosis of the core values of that culture. If results are the metric, he was the best who ever was at what he did. But he attained that height through hard and honest work, not through inheritance or blind chance. Always ready to use the latest technology to accomplish his goals and maintain his prominence, he nevertheless insisted that his most valuable asset was a circle of loyal friends. He walked with royalty and received unprecedented media attention for over four decades, but was still something of a small-town boy, astonished that anyone would think him special. In a profession stained by scandal, he stands out as the clearly identified exemplar of clean living integrity. In a society riven by divorce, he and his wife of his youth reared five attractive and capable children, all of whom are faithful Christians with their own intact families. He is, in short, an authentic American hero. Billy Graham was, for most of his life, a genuinely charismatic figure. Using such a term as charisma may seem a resort to a supernatural and therefore non-verifiable explanation. But social observers, as uncongenial to the supernatural as Max Weber and Eric Hoffer, have regarded charisma as palpably real and historically important. The term owes its presence in sociological literature to Weber, one of that discipline's patriarchs, who described the charismatic leader as a man able to inspire people to follow him and accept his authority, not out of fear or hope of material gain, but out of love, devotion, and enthusiasm. He typically possesses a strong sense of mission, a conviction that his mission is admirable and obtainable, and a confidence that he is particularly well-equipped to accomplish that mission, either because he's been chosen by God or some impersonal destiny, or simply because his peculiar set of talents seems so well-matched to the historical circumstance. Hoffer added to these elements a cunning estimate of human nature, a delight in symbols, spectacles, and ceremonials, a recognition that the innermost craving of a following is for communion, and that there can never be too much of it, a capacity for winning and holding the utmost loyalty of a group of able lieutenants. Graham's associates and enthusiasts would doubtless object to having their hero lumped in with some of the figures to whom students of politics and religion have applied the concept. Lenin, Hitler, Mussolini, Sun Myung-moon, Jim Jones, and L. Ron Hubbard, and would probably quibble over the cynical tone of Hoffer's characterization. But whenever they move beyond the sovereignty of God as an explanatory variable, they speak in terms that fit easily into these accounts of charisma. British evangelical John Stott agreed that what is most captivating about Billy is his sincerity. There isn't an iota of hypocrisy in the man. He is real. I sat in Haringey night after night asking over and over, what is the reason for his success? I finally decided that this was the first time most of these people had heard a transparently honest evangelist who was speaking from his heart and who meant and believed what he was saying. There's something captivating about that. Another old friend echoed Hoffer's cunning estimate of human nature. Graham, he said, is not an intellectual in the academic sense of the word, but he is a genius. He preaches to presidents and kings and queens in a way that no other man has ever been able to do. He is so people-sensitive. He knows just what to say, without either compromising the gospel or turning anyone off. I've watched him with a telescope, and I've watched him with a microscope, but I haven't changed my views of him. He has his faults, everyone does, but he is just an amazing, amazing man. Without doubt, it was Graham's prowess as a soul winner that commended him most powerfully to evangelical Christians, since no activity has higher standing in their minds than bringing the lost to Christ. But he was also an exemplar in other aspects of his personal life, leading the kind of life they feel they should lead, but seldom actually manage on a sustained basis. He arose around 7 o'clock each morning and performed a round of devotions that included prayer and the reading of 5 Psalms and 1 chapter of Proverbs. Psalms for how to get along with God. Proverbs for how to get along with man. After breakfast, he spent an hour in Bible study. Tried to get some exercise, in later years usually a brisk walk, and rounded out the workday with writing, reading, meetings, and telephone calls. During crusades, he rested most of the afternoon. We don't bother him, except for emergencies. He socialized little apart from obligatory planned events, and when he was in Montreat, rarely left his mountain retreat. He was strongly conscious of time, and expected others to share his concern. I become impatient if I feel I'm being used, he admitted. I value my time. I only have a certain amount left, and I want it to be put to the best use. Also, I hate to be late for an appointment. I don't mind waiting for someone for an hour if he's late, an assertion no visitor should take seriously, but I hate to be late. T.W. Wilson called him the most completely disciplined person I've ever known. What Wilson calls discipline, others label compulsion, even venturing to suggest that Graham was a classic workaholic. Bob Terrell, a perceptive Asheville newspaperman who worked for BGEA for several years, observed that Graham feels the urge to accomplish, and he doesn't think he is accomplishing anything when he's sitting by a fire on top of the mountain. He uses compelled quite frequently. I feel compelled to preach the gospel to as many people as I can, for as long as I can, and he is not satisfied if he is not busy. It's hard for him to relax and rest. He has the busiest schedule of any person I've ever known, but I think he likes it that way. Whenever he's on the road, he is constantly busy, sometimes for months at a time. If he goes to the Caribbean, he's always working on a book. He will say he would like nothing better than to stay home and rock and relax, but he really can't stand to be idle. Graham recognized that he took on more than he could handle with ease, but felt he sometimes had little choice. One of the things we are blessed with, he explained, is that I get opportunities that no other evangelical will ever get. For example, the Realtors' Convention in Honolulu, or the Bankers' Convention, or the National Chamber of Commerce. I've spoken to all of them. Or the American Bar Association. I've spoken to them two or three times. It takes so long to prepare those addresses, and I have to get help on them because they're specialized things. I don't mind speaking. If they'd ask me to come and give an evangelistic address, that's down my line. But these other kinds of speeches are so time-consuming. Ruth obviously felt her husband could exercise a bit more discipline without harming the evangelical cause. It's not necessary to speak at all, she interjected. I don't think the Lord called you to give all those strange addresses. Billy did not argue with her, but his response perhaps offered a clue as to why he kept accepting invitations. At the last ABA meeting, I stood around and shook hands until they finally told me that I had to go, that my plane was going to leave. So I just said, I have to go, and left. I didn't realize until about 2 days later that the next person in line was Justice Lewis F. Powell of the Supreme Court. But not long after that, he wrote me the most tremendous letter I've ever received about my ministry. Students of charismatic leaders have often noted that such men tend to stir a variety of emotions in the bosoms of their followers, a robust portion of which feelings are distinctly sexual. Leading a movement requires enormous energy, and the lines between political, spiritual, and sexual energy are not finely drawn on the map of the human psyche. That dynamic leaders, including religious leaders, experience and arouse strong sexual feelings should come as no particular surprise to anyone who pays attention. Thus, in light of his own quite obvious awareness of the imperious heights to which sexual temptation can mount, Billy Graham's spotless record as a faithful husband is an accomplishment his followers regarded with due appreciation. Marshall Frady, in an overwrought but often insightful biography, likened Graham to Billy Budd. A man with exactly that quality of raw, childlike, unblinking goodness, possessing a staggering passion for the pure, the sanitary, the wholesome, the upright. The allusion to Melville's classic American innocent is a natural one, and by no means completely off the mark, but it falls short at a crucial point, and that point is a theological one. Billy Budd was naturally good, and unable to believe that others did not share his elemental guilelessness. Billy Graham suffered from no such fantasies. He did indeed seem to have a passion for the pure, but never for a minute did he imagine that he, or anyone else, was beyond corruption. And that is the secret of his ability to avoid public scandal. No one listening to Graham warn against succumbing to the pleasures of the flesh would imagine that he derived his information solely from survey research data. Just as he had the wisdom to put others in charge of the purse, he had long clearly understood that his best strategy for avoiding sexual temptation was to keep himself out of its path. I'm sure I've been tempted, he said, especially in my younger years, but there has never been anything close to an incident. How had he managed that record? I took precautions. From the earliest days, I've never had a meal alone with a woman other than Ruth, not even in a restaurant. I've never ridden in an automobile alone with a woman. Even past 70, on the rare occasions when only he and his secretary were in a room together, he kept the door open wide so that none would suspect him of unseemly behavior. Before Graham entered a hotel room, T.W. Wilson checked it out to make sure no woman was hiding in the closet or the bathroom or lurking behind the drapes. Once he was in the room alone, he would not answer the door unless he knew for certain who had knocked. These are not measures taken by a man whose goodness is entirely childlike. At the same time, they are not hedges planted by a bloodless prude. He never suggested that he longed for the life of a monk, nor did he seem overly concerned simply with appearances. In 1983, shortly after actress Joan Collins appeared in a widely publicized nude spread in Playboy, Graham and Collins were booked onto the Merv Griffin show on the same day. His staff was worried. Larry Ross pointed out that everything she stood for was a complete about-face from what Mr. Graham stands for. For example, she talked about how to raise a 13-year-old daughter with a live-in boyfriend. Several times the audience booed some of her statements just because of the values they represented. "I didn't know what to do," I thought. "This is good television, but it's going to be a real shifting of gears. I thought Mr. Graham may not know everything she stands for." So I told him. He said, "Yes, I know." Well, when he went on, the first thing Merv said was, "Billy, were you aware that Joan Collins has appeared in Playboy?" Mr. Graham said, "Yes, I've seen it. Someone showed it to me at the barbershop." Right on national television, he said that. And then he went right into sharing the gospel. I'm sure he was concerned about his position on that program, but he was so confident in his message and what he stood for that he wasn't concerned about showing a side of Billy Graham people hadn't seen. In 1989, with the fallout from the Jim Baker and Jimmy Swaggart scandals far from settled, he noted in a casual but openly recorded exchange about current movies that he had recently seen Dangerous Liaisons. "I was staying near Times Square," he explained, "so I went to see it. It was based in the 18th century in France. It was very interesting. There were a couple of scenes that were pretty steamy. The people were about half nude, but you could see that anywhere. That a universally recognizable evangelist would attend such a movie in Times Square would scandalize many evangelicals. That he would talk about it freely to a writer with a tape recorder and give no indication that he preferred it not to be mentioned would cause anxiety among some of his colleagues. But just as he had freely acknowledged that he sometimes looked at the pictures in Playboy, he seemed unworried that someone might discover he had seen a pretty steamy movie without launching a boycott of the satanic film industry. In short, he seemed to know when he needed external controls and when he did not. Graham's passion for sexual fidelity doubtless stemmed primarily from his unshakable conviction that fidelity is God's will, and infidelity a mortal sin. But he also enjoyed an uncommon bond with Ruth, an uncommon woman. There would have been no Billy Graham as we know him today had it not been for Ruth, T.W. Wilson contended. They have been a great team, a model couple. Cliff Barrows described her as a tower. She has great insight, great sensitivity. She is a woman of the Bible, a scholar with the great capacities and gifts of her father, who was probably Bill's greatest teacher. Graham readily seconded these assessments. "She knows the Bible a lot better than I do," he admitted. "A lot of my sermons, I read to her, and she gives me little pointers and illustrations and scriptures to go with them. My son Ned said to me on the phone just last night, 'Dad, she's the most remarkable woman in the world. She has stayed in the background, but I just don't know any other person like her.' Of course, that's a boy talking about his mother, but as I looked at her as objectively as I can, I think he's right. She really is remarkable." Ruth's contributions to her husband's success were not limited to scripture verses and sermon illustrations. She also provided him with a measure of grit lacking in his own palliative style and a willingness to question and challenge him when his colleagues would not. "Ruth is a power," one former associate noted. "She has a little tougher mind than Billy's. She is not as afraid of offending. Billy is always auditioning." Ruth had sometimes been critical of the women's liberation movement. "I think we're being taken for a ride. It's men's lib because it's relieving them of the responsibility of supporting and caring for their families." But she seemed never to have felt that the biblical injunction to wives to be in subjection to their husbands required her to hide her opinions or feelings under a bushel. Nor did she seem the least bit awed to be married to one of the world's most famous men. Honorary degrees, red carpet treatment, and lavish compliments did not impress her. When Billy spoke glowingly of a reception given him by the President of Mexico, "He even embraced me," she quickly brought him down to earth. "Oh, Bill, don't be flattered. He did that to Castro, too." And unlike the wives of most of the prominent television evangelists, she never tried to insert herself into the limelight. "That's not my wad of gum." She did, however, quietly pursue her own forms of ministry. When she inherited a nice sum of money at her father's death, she gave it all away, bestowing much of it on an orphanage in Mexico. She also maintained an interest in female prisoners. In a case that received minor public attention, she befriended Velma Barfield, a North Carolina woman convicted and eventually executed for murder, after making her commitment to Christ while in prison. Barfield would call out from her cell, "I'm guilty. I did what I shouldn't have done, but please listen to me. Read your Bibles and pray. Turn to Jesus." From all appearances, her conversion did not appear to be a case of trying to impress the governor or the Board of Pardons and Paroles in the hope of winning a stay of execution. T.W. Wilson told of going with Billy Graham to visit the prison a week or two after Barfield had been executed. One person after another told Billy, "Velma Barfield was the finest person I ever met." The warden said, "She made an impact on our prison." Billy spoke, and when he gave the invitation, he said, "How many would like to adopt Velma's Jesus?" Without exaggeration, fully half of them stood up. Even the warden's father stood. I'm telling you, it was impressive. However extensive or effective her work with felons and orphans, Ruth's primary ministry, by all accounts, was with her children. PKs, preachers' kids, who rebel against a strict and public upbringing, are standard figures in the lore of religious communities. But the children of itinerant evangelists, who spend substantial portions of their lives away from home, may be at special risk. Billy Graham and his team knew that their own fame and personal dedication would not guarantee that their children would stay on the straight and narrow path. Grady Wilson recalled an evening early in Graham's ministry when the inner circle went out for a snack in Atlanta and invited Ma Sunday to go with them. "Boys," she said, "whatever you do, don't neglect your family." "I did. I traveled with Pa all over the country, and I sacrificed my children. I saw all four of them go straight to hell." Grady remembered that she sat there with tears running down her cheeks. "I know one of her sons jumped out of a hotel window somewhere in California. He was on drugs or something. Another one came to me in Phoenix, Arizona, just a panhandler. I gave him $25. Ma said, 'I wish you hadn't done it. He'll just take it out and buy more whiskey.' We remembered that. I know Billy has prayed night and day by the hour all around the world for his children. All of them have been filled with plenty of adrenaline, from the oldest to the youngest. But Ruth stayed up on that mountain and took care of them, and all of them have turned out to be just exceptional Christians." For a time, as had been true of Franklin, it appeared that Ned, the youngest son, might spoil the family record. After graduating from the Stony Brook School, Ned dabbled briefly with college, spent 2 years as a mountaineering instructor while living at home, then sampled the curriculum at three more schools before he finally graduated from Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma. He admits to a rebellious impulse, but insists it was aimed not at his parents. "I never had any reason to rebel against them." Rather, he asserted, he was resisting God's call on my life to go into the ministry. "It wasn't that I had had bad examples. It was that I knew what entering the ministry would mean, turning everything over to God." Ned manifested his rebellion by turning to more than a casual use of drugs, including cocaine. Once again, the Graham philosophy of child-rearing prevailed. "While I was embroiled in all that," he recalled, "my parents were just very patient. They expressed concern and displeasure over the behavior, but never once did they make me feel they rejected me as a person. Their love for me was always unconditional. Their home was always open, no matter what condition I was in. They gave themselves to me, and I never felt their love was conditioned on meeting some requirement. Eventually, their grace and love were just irresistible. Also, once again, the formula worked. In mid-1991, at age 33, Ned lacked only one course before finishing a degree at Fuller Seminary, and was serving as pastor of adult ministries in a Tacoma Baptist church. He also serves as president of East Gates Ministry, an American-based operation dedicated to assisting a wide range of mission and indigenous Christian efforts in the People's Republic of China. Though it obviously cannot explain the success that brought him fame, the very fact that he was extraordinarily famous unquestionably added to Billy Graham's appeal, and the way he handled that fame further warmed those who were drawn to the glow of his celebrity. No person in the 20th century received as much sustained popular attention and was as widely admired as Billy Graham. He placed high on public opinion poll listings of the nation's and the world's most admired men virtually every year since 1951. In a survey conducted by Christian Century to discover which of 11 living giants of the Christian faith could be identified by American church people, 67% of respondents correctly identified Billy Graham. The next most familiar giant was known to only 5%. Contestants in the 1976 Miss USA beauty pageant in Niagara Falls named him the greatest person in the world today, and in a 1978 Ladies Home Journal survey, only God outpointed him in the category of achievements in religion. He was once named Time's Man of the Year, and in 1990, Life listed him among the 100 most important Americans of the 20th century. The only other figure from the world of religion to make the list was his old adversary, Reinhold Niebuhr. In 1990, Graham was honored with a star on Hollywood Boulevard. Graham's celebrity gave him entree to others of similar repute. When Mikhail Gorbachev visited the United States for a summit meeting with Ronald Reagan in 1988, for example, Graham was the only clergyman invited to be present at his arrival and attend the state dinner in his honor. The evangelist long defended his association with celebrities and the publicity machinery that kept his star well-polished and ascendant by contending that though he personally abhorred the attention he received, he went along with it as essential to attracting an audience for his message. He admitted that he might have paid more attention to public opinion polls than he ought to. I wonder sometimes if I'm pleasing God or man. But his awareness of and concern over his need for approval served to keep what can easily be a colossal ego in admirable check. His standard opening offer, "Please call me Billy," seemed utterly genuine and reflected his uneasiness with honorific treatment he felt he had not earned. "I don't really like these honorary degrees at all," he said. "They've given me so many that they've become meaningless, and I don't ever list them. I couldn't even name all the places I've received degrees from. Many times, if they invite you to speak at a commencement, it's just automatic that they give you a degree. In the beginning, I think the first degree I got was from Houghton College. I was quite pleased. And the first degree I got from a Catholic institution, Belmont Abbey, I was honored. I should be honored about the others, I suppose, but I don't have the feeling of appreciation that maybe I ought to. It's just something I sort of endure. Unless, of course, some major school like Harvard or Yale or Princeton were to give me one." His oft-expressed desire to move about the world incognito was understandable. Johnny Lenning observed that sometimes he must feel like a piece of meat, just being pushed into a room, told that the person in the gray coat is the most important man in the room and the one he ought to pay most attention to. Then, 20 minutes later, pushed into another room and told that the lady in the green dress is the prime minister, and then trying to talk to those people through an interpreter, knowing that everything he says is loaded with political implications. It must be so draining on him. Even when no one expected anything in particular from him, the simple fact that every eye in the room was on him took an inevitable toll. Robert Firm recalled a dinner he had shared with Graham in a nondescript restaurant in San Francisco. All through the meal, people would walk by and just reach out and touch him lightly on the shoulder or brush his sleeve. There must have been 20 people who did that. A few stopped and said, "Hello, Billy Graham." One or two teenage girls came over and got his autograph. Here in Asheville, he's pretty free to go out in restaurants. People recognize him and leave him alone, but nowhere else. The wish for privacy, however, was mixed with a measure of gratification at being recognized. Graham's sister, Jean Ford, noted that he very much wants to be able to be in a restaurant or walk through a hotel lobby in privacy, and yet he would almost feel hurt if people didn't recognize him. We were on an elevator with him a couple of weeks ago in the Washington Hilton, and people didn't recognize him, and he initiated the "Good morning, how are you?" He wouldn't say, "I'm Billy Graham," but as soon as they looked at him, they knew who he was immediately. I think there's a paradox there in his personality, but also, I think he never wants to pass anybody up and have them think he is aloof or unapproachable, because he's not. I think he very much wants to be warm. People around him sometimes try to make him out to be unapproachable, but that's not the way he is. He is still very much a Southern gentleman. Those who knew Graham best insisted convincingly that his fame had not gone to his head. BGEA photographer Russ Busby, who probably spent more time in the evangelist's presence than any member of the association, except Cliff Barrows and the Wilson brothers, and who is noted for his wry humor and independent spirit, proposed that the biggest asset Billy has is his honest humility. He has an ego, like the rest of us. Sometimes it takes off, but he brings it back under control. To my knowledge, he seldom thinks more highly of himself than he ought to. When he does, it only lasts briefly. I don't mean weeks, I mean a day or two, and that's it. Billy Graham is human, but he works on it. It takes a big ego to be a big preacher. But the difference between Billy and the others is that when God wants to speak to him, at least he can get his attention. Like his twin desires for privacy and recognition, Graham's humility stood in paradoxical tension with his understandable delight, also real, in his fame and accomplishments. He would muse about our little ministry, suggest that its heyday was long past, and express doubt that future historians will have any real interest in it. Ben noted almost offhandedly that a recent crusade crowd was the largest gathering of any kind in that whole region. Or he would make some reference to Wheaton's Billy Graham Center, whose voluminous and carefully tended archives virtually guarantee that he will not be forgotten. He also could not completely free his spirit of all traces of competition. At Columbia, South Carolina in 1987, a few months before Pope John Paul II was scheduled to appear in the same stadium, he urged his supporters to do whatever they could to fill the stadium for the closing service on Sunday afternoon. "We don't have to wait for the Pope to come to fill it," he said. Then, as his overwhelmingly Protestant audience broke into enthusiastic applause, he seemed to sense that he had said more than he intended, and he tried to regain the high ground. "I hope he does fill it," he said. "I think he will. He's a wonderful Pope. But it would be good preparation for him. It would show people what it looks like filled." Though he worked hard to be humble about himself, Graham allowed his natural ebullience to run free when talking of others. His penchant for hyperbole is legendary and good-naturedly discounted by his friends and associates. Crusade organist John Ennis recalled a service at which the evangelist had introduced his old friend Stuart Hamblin as the greatest hymn writer in America today. Ennis said, "We were all thinking, he's got to be kidding. Stuart had written, 'It is no secret what God can do,' and a couple like that. But he was hardly the greatest hymn writer in America." Another time, Billy described a crusade city as one of the most beautiful he had ever visited. "We were all wondering what part of the city he had been in. It was one of the ugliest places you could imagine." Ennis, however, did not regard such statements as either conscious untruths or insincere flattery. "I don't think Billy has ever been a liar. I think at the moment he says those things, he truly means them. He builds people up. He's a natural builder-upper." Asked about this tendency, T.W. Wilson chuckled wryly and told of seeing a note Graham had addressed to a mutual friend with the inscription, "To my best buddy, Well, Wilson said, I had one addressed the same way. But he really means it. He might say the same thing to a number of people, and he means it with everybody he says it to. Graham's siblings deny that their brother inherited the tendency to exaggerate from their parents, but insist that whatever its source, it was a trait of long standing. It's always been there, as far as I know, said Gene Ford. And Melvin Graham acknowledged that Billy Frank has very seldom had anything negative to say about folks. He's never been anywhere that he doesn't come home and say, I just love that place. I love those people. Never seen anybody like them. With the team, he's always bragging on this one and that one, talking about what a tremendous influence they've had on him, telling them, without you, I don't know how we would have made it. That's something he's done for years and years. If he's with you, he's going to make you feel like you're just about the most important person he's ever met. And you know, he leaned forward and a big knowing smile flashed across his open farmer's face. That don't make anybody mad. And of course it works both ways. That's one reason people like him so. Graham professed no great insight about himself. I'm not a self-analyzer, he said. I know some people who just sit and analyze themselves all the time. I just don't do that. I don't ask myself why I do this or that. I rarely think introspectively like that. He may not have spent much time thinking about what kind of person he was, but he thought a great deal about what kind of person he wanted to be. When asked what one word he would like people of future generations to use when they characterized his life and his ministry, he hesitated not a moment, snapping his head slightly as if to lock it into position to fire precisely at a key target. He thrust out his jaw and said, integrity. That's what I've worked for all my life, integrity. Depending on how one chooses to interpret his occasional reconstructions of his past actions and motives, his relationship with Richard Nixon offers a key example. Graham's record may not turn out absolutely free of spot or wrinkle, but it is nonetheless remarkable. Bob Evans, who was quite aware of his friend's private insecurities and imperfections, said of him, there is no dark side to Billy Graham. I don't feel there is any secret insincerity or hidden agenda. He is as transparent a person as I have ever known. He makes mistakes. He is human. He has made some false moves and has tried to correct them. But it is not like the movie stars' biographies, where you find that Rock Hudson was a secret homosexual or anything like that. There is nothing of that sort with Billy Graham. Happily, such laudations are not limited to professional colleagues or others with a stake in putting the best face on the ministry. George Bergen, a rough-hewn handyman who acts as caretaker for the Grahams' home in Montreat, and whose wife helped Gruth with the cooking and housework, volunteered as he maneuvered a jeep down the steep and narrow road that connects Little Piney Cove to the village below. You've been visiting some mighty good people today. My wife and I have been knowing Mr. and Ms. Graham for 15 years, and I'm telling you, they're the same inside the house as out. But perhaps the most succinct assessment of the evangelist's character came from his old friend Chuck Templeton. Though still convinced that Graham had committed intellectual suicide back in 1949, that his theology was untenable, and that his vulnerability to being used by the famous and powerful was a notable shortcoming, Templeton observed with considerable feeling, whatever you may think about him, you've simply got to recognize that Billy Graham is a good guy. Early in his ministry, Graham occasionally suggested that he felt he would not live to be an old man. In part, that may have been a symptom of an overall preoccupation with doom that he seemed to manifest. But it was also a reasonable conclusion to draw from a life that, for all its vigor, had been marked with illness and affliction. In addition to the publicized ailments that forced him to cancel or postpone crusades, Graham suffered from an astonishing assortment of ailments, including hernias, ulcers, tumors, cysts, polyps, infections, pneumonia, chronic high blood pressure, throbbing headaches, spider bites, and a series of falls that broke 18 of his ribs. Most of his associates shy away from labeling him an indisputable hypochondriac, but they admit that he sometimes got high mileage from his disabilities. Jean Ford smiled as she compared her brother to his wife. Ruth will go to her grave saying, I'm fine. Never felt better. And Billy will say, you see, I told you I was sick. The things that are wrong with him are real things, and some of them are very odd and peculiar, but he is very open with his hurts. I don't know whether there's any hypochondria there or not, but he doesn't mind letting you know if he's not feeling well. I'm sure anyone in his position would be tempted to use that.